is CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor. Here's John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. I welcome Colonel Jeff McCausland, United States Army retired, CBS News, to guide me through the immediate landscape after Afghanistan. The concern is NATO, the alliance that has kept the peace since the Second War. And yet, Jeff, a very good evening to you. Thank you for this. You served in and around NATO through the critical decades when Europe was going from a transition of the Soviet Union to what we have now, the Russian Federation, and Eastern Europe was freed to make mistakes. NATO was obviously vital then. 20 years later, after Afghanistan, hard questions in Berlin and London. What is the answer, Jeff? Is NATO still necessary?
Well, good evening, John. I think the question is a very appropriate one in this moment. You know, in the aftermath of the demise of the Soviet Union, NATO, of course, is a collective defense organization designed to bring together everyone in the defense if the territory is attacked. And the Soviet Union, obviously in its presence with the Warsaw Pact, encouraged that coalescence. In the aftermath of the Cold War, for a period of time, NATO leaders talked about going out of area or going out of mission. And the wars in the Balkans, with many worried threatened stability in Europe, gathered NATO's attention. But that was certainly not like the threat of the Soviet Union. And then along came 9/11, and it was global terrorism. And for the first time in its history, Article 5 of the Collective Defense Guarantee was invoked by our allied partners. And Americans, I think, frequently forget that the war in Afghanistan was a NATO mission. And when the withdrawal began, there were 2,500 American soldiers in Afghanistan, and there were 7,000 NATO troops. Now, in the aftermath of that withdrawal, the question is combating terrorism globally sufficient to keep that alliance together? Or alternatively, particularly if the United States now seems more focused, as it is, on its global competitiveness with particularly China and Russia, do the alliance partners also want to now gather themselves for that type of a long-term effort to confront the Russian Federation and China? And there seems to be mixed reviews on that. Have you traveled through European capitals?
The Secretary General of NATO, Jens Stoltenberg, is quoted in these last days as commenting that he was consulted, NATO was consulted before the Afghanistan withdrawal, the final days. However, his concerns are elsewhere. Mr. Stoltenberg said that the talk of a new separate European Union military force, which some have argued is necessary in the aftermath of the collapse of Afghanistan, this is reporting from the New York Times, Stephen Erlanger, could only weaken the transatlantic alliance and divide the continent. I've heard talk of this European Union army for some time. Is it real, Jeff, or is it just a debating point when there are moments when there are elections?
At this point, I would say, frankly, it's largely a debating point and one that has come up periodically throughout the history of the alliance. If you want to talk of the WEU, the Western European Union at one point, fielding its own force. But the problem has always been for the NATO allies, are they interested in defending territory or are they interested in defending global interests? And if you're going to do the latter, then you've got to develop not only capabilities, military forces that can do that, but capacity. And even Stoltenberg in the article you mentioned, John, talked about the fact that when the United States said we're leaving Afghanistan, to some degree, any consultation was somewhat academic or artificial, I think is the word he used, because NATO forces knew they didn't have the capacity to sustain forces at that distance. The airlift, the sea lift, logistics, the signal, and all those things that only the United States provides. And as a consequence, if you're going to build that alternative capability, then you've got to be willing to invest the funds to do that. And I find very few European parliamentarians of any country who get on their stump when they run for re-election and argue for dramatic increases in defense spending. Even beyond that, we now live in the 21st century where really we have now five domains of warfare to prepare for, not only air, land, and sea, the traditional ones, but we have to be prepared in cyber, a growing area of conflict and where the war will start if there is another war. And the other one, is, of course, is space. So not only do the Europeans have to provide capabilities in those traditional areas, land forces, air forces, and sea forces, but if they're going to be independent, will they make the investments now for those five domains? And I think it's doubtful given the state of the economies.
We're looking at a situation that's changed dramatically since the late 20th century with the arrival of China as a peer competitor, militarily, cyber, all of the above. And NATO has not obviously a role in the what now looks to be the containment or the encircling of China's aggression. I mentioned the Quad, India, Australia, Japan, and the U.S. I mentioned what appears to be a new announcement forthcoming, the U.S., the U.K., and Australia working together. Certainly Japan has traded tough words with China recently. NATO's involved in none of this, to my understanding at this moment. Does that make NATO a second-class theater, Jeff? Are we moving all of our energy and effort to East Asia where NATO is not invited?
I think it certainly could if we're not careful. I mean, I think if you look at it geostrategically, the 20th century was, for the United States, the century of Europe. We fought three wars in Europe, World Wars I and II and the Cold War. And anybody who looks at it, it's one area where Democrats and Republicans, I think, geostrategically agree that the 21st century is the century of Asia and the Pacific with the rise or the return of China, however you want to describe that. And I'm back again to force capabilities. What force capabilities do the Europeans provide that can assist us in that type of a military competition in the Pacific? And the answer is very few. The British just recently moved one of their aircraft carriers to the Pacific for a trip, took it to Japan. And while that was terrific, their ability to sustain a naval force right now in the Pacific, I would say, does not exist, as it does for all our partners. The areas that they could assist the United States if they decided to would be, of course, in cyber and, of course, in economics. But the question is, do they want to confront China or do they want to cooperate with China for economic benefit? And that's a hard question they have to ask about their own economies. And finally, of course, from the U.S. perspective, one can make the argument that what the Europeans should be able to do is provide sufficient land forces in Europe to deter further aggression by the Russian Federation with United States support if a crisis occurred, with naval forces and air forces. But it doesn't look like me right now that even in that area, NATO countries are willing to collectively make that type of an investment.
We look then to what NATO was built for, which is the Soviet Union. Doesn't exist. Russian Federation does. It's a shadow of what was once a dominant two-continent military. However, it is sizably at the point of contact, overwhelming. I'm looking at Belarus. I'm certainly looking at the mission into Syria and the occupation of eastern Ukraine with cutouts, surrogates, auxiliaries. The Russian Federation remains a threat, but is NATO prepared to deal with the way Russia is conducting its near abroad, which is hybrid warfare? Is NATO built for that, Jeff?
I say right now it is not and needs to be addressed. We see the Russians, for example, as part of hybrid warfare, taking advantage of disinformation campaigns. Coming in the last couple of weeks, we've seen significant efforts by Russian disinformation campaigns, for example, trying to drive greater fissures between the United States and its European allies over the withdrawal from Europe. Clear evidence of social media efforts against British veterans associations, emphasizing the point that, you know, Brits died, the Americans let you down, you can't depend on the Americans. That's all part and parcel of an ongoing Russian disinformation campaign. As a consequence, then, is NATO prepared to deal in that particular environment? And don't forget, John, as well, one of NATO's strengths, or some would call it a weakness, is collective decision making. How they react in a particular crisis has to be a consensus of all 27 members. And that, even if you had overwhelming capabilities, your ability to make decisions quickly is very, very hard.
NATO concerns itself with Eastern Europe greatly, and Ukraine is a major story. But I want to focus on the Baltic states, where I don't think it's commonplace to understand that the threat, the scale of threat the Baltic states feel. I know that I've had conversations with a colleague of mine who spent some weeks in Vilnius, the capital of Lithuania. It's real to them, Jeff. Cyber and also incursion into their territory, sending migrants that are flown in from Baghdad into Vilnius and burdening the population with really people who are deracinated and need help. But in any event, it's Belarus being aggressive. We also know that the Baltic states have a history of being abused by Russia, Moscow, before that Petersburg. So is NATO prepared? Is anyone prepared for this level of fear that's going on in the Baltic states? And I'm going to guess that it extends into Poland, because Poland is second to none in believing that the Russians are wicked.
Yeah, exactly. And of course, in the Baltic states, particularly in Latvia and in Lithuania, you mentioned, John, even prior to the end of the Cold War, you had significant Russian populations. One of the things that would happen in the Soviet military is when you retired from the Soviet military, you were given your apartment. That was part and parcel of your retirement. And many military officers in the Soviet military would retire, particularly into Lithuania and Latvia, being near the coast and standard of living that they liked. So you have very large Russian populations. And we saw how the Russians exploited the presence of Russian populations when they moved into Crimea and when they moved into eastern Ukraine. They could easily trump up some kind of an argument that in Latvia or Lithuania, the government was, if you will, harassing those particular Russian minorities, and use that as a reason for an incursion or a hybrid incursion by little green men. We've also seen clear efforts on the part of the Russians in a couple of cases, cyber attacks against banks in the Baltic republics. And so this is really where, you know, the NATO Article 5 meets the geography of Europe right now, and whether or not European partners in Central Europe, Germans, British, French, Belgique, Dutch, are willing to see their soldiers fight and die to defend Vilnius or defend Riga, I think is an open question.
We're not going to settle this, Jeff, but for now, do you believe NATO has weathered the storm of the Afghanistan retreat, or are we still looking at a brittle alliance that is asking hard questions?
I think we are seeing an alliance that is only now beginning in the aftermath of Afghanistan, which gave it purpose to now define what its role is in future. And this goes on both sides of the Atlantic. Of course, Joe Biden campaigned on the United States is back, America is back in dealing with allies. Well, Europeans want to know, great, what does that exactly mean? And at the same point, as you rightfully point out, John, many European leaders calling for some kind of alternatives and describing the withdrawal from Afghanistan as a debacle. I saw one British parliamentarian saying the greatest disaster since Suez. Armin Laschet, who is Mrs. Merkel's chosen successor to be Chancellor of Germany in the upcoming elections in only a few weeks, has called it the biggest debacle in the history of the alliance. So with this now having occurred, what is the glue that holds this organization together? What is the interest of the United States? And it comes at a difficult moment as well because of the pandemic, because of the fear of more refugees, because the United States is looking elsewhere because of the Pacific, and also uniquely Britain's position as a, as if you will, the bridge between Europe and the United States is in a difficult spot because of Brexit. The departure of Great Britain from the European Union also further complicates this and leaves the British at this point having to make some very, very serious choices about national security policy themselves.
I'm speaking with Colonel Jeff McCausland, United States Army retired, a veteran of NATO, as well as CBS News. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.